Yeah, welcome back to Coast AM. Now, if you're interested in getting some more information about our last guest, Sonia Grace, her website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And of course, if you missed any of the show or any of the other shows, you can become a Coast Insider. It is the best deal in podcasting. Check it out. Well, now it's time, ladies and gentlemen, to turn off your cell phones, open a window, and grab your notepad. We're bringing on William Henry. We're going to be talking about the Ark of the Covenant. And William's new book frames it in a very different light. He's calling this a Judgment Day device. And he's drawing this from a lot of artwork and a lot of research into the different interpretations of the Ark. What it had in it, what it was used for. And you are going to be stunned to learn much more than you ever did in Sunday school or any other documentary on the subject. Let me read you a little snippet of an introduction of his book. While Christians seek signs for Jesus' second coming, the Jews await the Messiah, and Muslims await the 12th Imam. A powerful device with unearthly power is awaiting discovery by one of them. The device is the Lost Ark of the Covenant, typically thought as a golden rectangular box made by Moses to contain the tablets of the law. But most do not realize it will be a sign or a seal of the Messiah's return to earth. The secrets of the Holy Grail, right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. Now, we are going to dive into the mysteries of the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to bring on investigative mythologist William Henry, discuss the religious implications of the end time prophecies. William Henry, welcome back to Coast AM.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I want to send out a heartfelt hello to George and wish him well.
Great. Yeah, he should be back tomorrow and explain the mysterious circumstances that led to his absence. But in the meantime, we're going to do the best we can, and we're going to talk to you about your new book. Now, what was the inspiration for you to dedicate so much time on one historical object?
Well, of course, the Ark of the Covenant is considered the most mysterious relic in all human history. It's been sought for centuries, ever since its disappearance around 600 BC. So you always have to pay attention to it as a mythologist and a seeker of these ancient truths and mysteries, as I am, as well as many others. But the thing that really got me going on it was I was doing some research on Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, and the conflict, present unfolding conflict between Iran and Israel. And I learned that the Ark of the Covenant has a place in Islamic end time prophecy. And I was stunned to learn this because in all the books I've ever read about the Ark of the Covenant, Islam is never mentioned. And they certainly never mentioned that the Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah, would be the one guided by Allah to recover and reveal the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, that's the meaning of this figure's name, the Mahdi. He's the guided one because he will be guided to recover the Ark, and it will become his symbol. And I started pulling on that golden thread and started looping it through Judaism and Christianity and realized, hey, there's a whole story here about that has not really been told about the Ark of the Covenant's role in end time prophecy. And of course, many people believe that we are experiencing a form of the end time prophecy today. So we've got to be paying attention to the possibility here of the revelation of the Ark of the Covenant.
Now, this is interesting. Am I to understand that there is a mention of it in the Quran or the associated texts of the Quran?
In the Quran, as well as in the associated texts, Muhammad is believed to have possessed the Ark of the Covenant. And that's really a revolutionary thought. And it's the one that really sparked my quest to really discover this, because as we follow this thought through, we know that presently the Iranian government, at least factions of it, are hugely obsessed with the hastening the return of the Mahdi. In fact, the thought is that they want to create chaos in our world today in order to hasten the arrival of this figure. And what that means is that they must be all over the search for the Ark of the Covenant, and understanding that that is part of the fulfillment of the prophecy of the return of this figure or appearance of the Mahdi.
So the three dominant religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, all have an interest in finding it.
Exactly. Now, the thing is that, of course, when you think of the Ark of the Covenant, you're thinking of it as a Jewish relic. Most don't associate it with Jesus. However, I've made a case in the book, both from a biblical perspective as well as the perspective of Christian art, that Jesus indeed did possess the Ark of the Covenant. Hmm. And will be, if he is the Messiah, by definition, had to have sought, possessed, and utilized the Ark of the Covenant.
Okay.
And
I want to ask you about that. But first, let's just sort of give people the one paragraph of what we know as the Ark of the Covenant, where it came into being.
The traditional view, as told in the book of Exodus, is that the Ark of the Covenant was made by Moses, actually a craftsman named Bezalel, at the base of Mount Sinai. It was made after a pattern given by God to Moses, which means the earthly ark is a copy of a heavenly original. There's at least two arks, one on earth, one on heaven, or one in heaven. It's thought to be a rectangular box made of wood, special wood, called setim wood, covered with gold, that functioned primarily, or in the exoteric world, as a container for the tablets of the law, the Ten Commandments, the rod of Aaron, the rod of enlightenment, the flask of manna, the cruse of anointing oil. However, there is a second track, a second trend that Israelite symbol specialists follow, and that says that the Ark of the Covenant is not just a container or a box. It is, in fact, the throne of God. And it is through this throne that this God being, who manifests as a luminous humanoid but non-physical figure, appears on the earth plane.
Wow, that is a lot to digest. Now, I'm sure a lot of people are going back to the Indiana Jones movie when they found the ark.
Throw it out.
And they had all that power and everything like that. But yeah, it really does come from when the Jews were getting out of Egypt, the Exodus. They go through the Red Sea, and they were in the Sinai desert, and that's when Moses went up and got the Ten Commandments and brought them down, and that's when they crafted this ark. I mean, that's the traditional Old Testament story, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
But also within the Old Testament is this belief that the ark is a throne, and that Yahweh manifested between the cherubim, the winged beings, on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is always something I've wondered about. Every time we see Moses holding the Ten Commandments, they're always in Hebrew. But to my reckoning, Hebrew really wasn't established at that point. Wouldn't it be more accurate if the Ten Commandments were written out, say, in hieroglyphics?
That's a very good possibility. I mean, Moses, after all, was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and spent a fair amount of his life in Egypt. So very good possibility.
Okay. So now let's go back to this other thread that you are presenting, that it is a device. It is the throne of God. Where does this come from?
Well, this actually comes from various biblical texts, including Ezekiel. Isaiah had a description of Yahweh on his ark throne, the book of Samuel, Jeremiah. This idea is sprinkled throughout the Bible in references to the ark. In fact, the ark is thought to serve as Yahweh, the Old Testament God's footstool. And that became a real key for unlocking this, because what I started to find were numerous examples, as we can discuss in detail later, of, for example, Jesus in his ascension scenes is sitting on a throne with his feet propped on a footstool. By biblical definition, that's the Ark of the Covenant. That is the ascension throne of God. And so it would make perfect sense that this device, And by the way, Rob, it's important for us to understand that the word, I intentionally chose the word device because it means a sign and a symbol, but a device is also a tool and an appliance. And in my view, the Ark functioned on all of those levels. It was the sign of the divine presence of God, but it was also clearly a tool or an appliance, an implement that was utilized to do work. So it toggles back and forth, or phases back and forth, if you will, between the symbolic realm and the material realm.
Right. As a container, as we are typically supposed to think of it, and this new interpretation as a device. Well, give us some examples to this reference of it being a footstool or device. What did they actually say? Give us some quotes from Isaiah just so we can get a sense of how these references are phrased.
Okay. Let's see. Let me go to down here to the book of Ezekiel here. Okay. is a very good one. It's one of the most influential documents that says Yahweh was, I refer to him as an ark rider, because what you have to factor in here too, Rob, is that the ark produced a divine pillar, a cosmic conduit called the Shekinah, and which literally means the divine presence, and is visualized in Judeo-Christian art either as a rainbow, an arcing rainbow between the two cherubim, or incredibly, and I have several examples of this in the book, it's shown as a beam of light, pure white light emanating from the ark, looking like a Star Trek transporter. It's incredible, this visualization of it. And so what you get in the book of Ezekiel, for example, is that he's describing the throne, and he says, seated above the likeness of a throne was the likeness as if it were a human form. Then we go to Isaiah, who said, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Those are two good examples there that refer to the Ark of the Covenant as a throne with a humanoid figure sitting upon it. Ezekiel then also, as does Isaiah, describes the figures on the throne as lightning-like or rainbow-like. And the picture that emerges is that we're describing some kind of an ethereal being, the Lord, who's enthroned between the two cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant, and it is through this pillar of light or this rainbow energy that this God figure manifests.
Okay, so long before Jesus was walking the earth, this Ark of the Covenant was brought to Jerusalem and was housed in Solomon's Temple, right?
That's correct. It was Solomon's Temple was built atop Jerusalem's Mount Moriah as a permanent home for the Ark.
Okay. And do you have any information about, aside from it obviously being, you know, revered, did it come to use in this alternative device function, or was it simply just there and they, as a source of reverence?
No, it's much more than a source of reverence. In fact, one of the most fascinating aspects of the Ark that I uncovered was that it was, in a term I use, it's contagiously holy. And what that means is that Solomon's Temple was divided into two sections, the holy place and the most holy place. There was a curtain, a veil, that separated the two that was had a starry scene on it. And the idea was is that as you crossed through over this veil, through this curtain, you were literally entering heaven as you entered the most holy place. This is where the Ark of the Covenant was placed. The most holy place was a cube-shaped room with its walls covered with gold. The Ark is sitting in there. And what would happen is that the distinction between the holy place and the most holy place is that the holy place is filled with objects that could become holy. The most holy place had objects that could transmit the divine presence or holiness to everyone and everything that came into contact with it. So as you crossed through this veil and entered heaven in the most holy place, you yourself were subjected to or underwent a transformation from an ordinary mortal being into an immortal being referred to as an angel or a being of light. And a question that I explore in the book is whether or not this is a literal or a metaphorical experience. In my view, it was literal. The high priest and others who were allowed to enter this most holy place and interact with the ark were transformed or transubstantiated, if you will, into light beings. And beyond that, what's incredible, Rob, is that it describes the individuals as being able to sit on this throne and be beamed through the divine presence.
Good heavens. So what you're saying is, now, would this happen? Because my understanding, they could only enter the room on Yom Kippur.
That's correct.
Okay.
The Day of Atonement.
Okay. And it wasn't just a matter of going in, but they were actually going somewhere. Where do you think they went?
Well, that's the big question. They go to Sion. Sion is the name of the celestial throne, the celestial Jerusalem. Jerusalem itself is also referred to as Sion, the place of peace. And what you begin to understand is that there's an earthly Sion and a celestial Sion that's located in some place in space-time. The research that I did for my most recent book, Before the Judgment Day Device, is called The Secret of Sion. I followed this trail all the way to the center of the Milky Way galaxy, piecing it together from various traditions, and came to a supposition that maybe the location where they are going to is, in fact, the center of the galaxy, but based upon ancient Egyptian stargate metaphysics, or what I referred to as ancient Egyptian stargate metaphysics, the journey would have taken them through Orion, because in the Egyptian tradition, Orion was the gateway to the throne. And even in America here in Nashville, where I live, the ancient mound builders that lived here taught this path of souls of leaving Earth and jumping into the Milky Way and going through Orion's gate to a throne, to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So that's the big picture of where I trace this. And we have to at least speculate on this, because, again, when John the Revelator opened a hole in heaven, as was described in the book of Revelation, he saw the ark at the throne of Christ. So, again, there's an earthly ark and a heavenly ark. And as I thought about this, Rob, I thought, wait a minute, this almost sounds like the Ark of the Covenant is a docking station. We're talking about this is a transportation device for some super high vibrational beings, rainbow beings, lightning-like beings, light beings. And maybe, for some reason, they need an anchoring point on Earth. And that's what the Ark of the Covenant served as that docking station, or we might even go so far as to say, and it sounds crazy, it's a Stargate device.
No. We're completely open to new ideas here. Well, okay, if people, these high priests, were able to transport through this device in the Holy of Holies, do you think that there were other beings or entities coming into our reality with this device?
Isaiah is crystal clear that the seraphim, the highest order of angels, were present in the most holy place. And they're described as rainbow-like beings and as non-human but humanoid-looking physical or non-physical beings. So the picture that emerges for me is that this most holy place, this golden cube, was a sort of a protective realm where these beings could come and go. And humans could go through a process of transformation. And mind you, when they would enter into the most holy place, it was a matter of raising their consciousness beyond ordinary human consciousness. They achieved cosmic consciousness. They ate the star food, the bread of the host that enabled them to see the presence of God. Sounds hallucinogenic. Very well could have been. It awakened their consciousness. They put on the special robe. They crossed over the veil. They were obsessed with this idea of perfection and purity, and all of this being going towards this idea that what they were trying to do was to raise their vibration to a level such that they could come into contact with, to not only perceive these fast-moving beings.
The highest spirits. Hold it right there, William. I want to ask you about the ancient school of wisdom that surely must have been involved with these high priests. We're talking with William Henry. You're listening to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone. Stay right there. We're coming right back. Yes, welcome back to Coast AM. We are in the midst of rewriting history once again with our guest, William Henry. His book is called The Judgment Day Device, wherein he describes the Ark of the Covenant not only as this incredible relic, but perhaps something that all of the three major religions are tied into when it comes to their end time prophecies. We're going through the whole subject matter, and you don't want to miss a minute of it. We're coming right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. And William, right before the break, I want to let you finish your thought, because I was asking about the Holy of Holies, the Solomon's Temple, where the Ark resided for quite a long time. And you were painting a picture of this room and this device as opening up some sort of quantum gateway wherein people could be somehow redirected and sent to Zion, or perhaps even people from other places in the galaxy could be brought in with the mystical power of this device. And what were you saying about the sorts of people that were involved in this process? I want to let you finish that thought.
Yeah, and thank you, Rob. They fall into a category of what later became known as the Merkabah mystics. The Merkabah is a word that means throne mystics. And so these were individuals who were deeply steeped in this belief that we could transform ourselves into beings of pure light and pure love and manifest what's known as our light body, or the Merkabah body. And through this body, then, we could literally travel the stars. And it was the most holy place of Solomon's Temple where this transformation could be effected. And what happens is that the corollary here is that what really fascinated me, too, is that just like the Ark, which was made by a precise pattern given to God by Moses, so too was not only the tabernacle in the wilderness, the temporary temple for the Ark, but also the plan for Solomon's temple was made after a precise pattern given by God. And it was God, Yahweh, the Old Testament God, who prescribed not only the Ark to be made, but also the clothing worn by the high priest. This clothing was covered with stars, just like the veil that separated the holy place from the most holy place. And it's from this that we deduce this idea that what they're talking about is a transformation of the human, of taking off the human body and putting on what's referred to as the star body, the celestial body, or the light body, or in Tibet, they actually refer to it as the rainbow body, or the perfect body, meaning whole, holy, and complete. So it's all about transformation, and the not only the belief, but the understanding of how the human body can be morphed into a humanoid but non-physical energy being.
It seems to me that this technology, this device, the Ark of the Covenant, and how they were using it, really comes from Moses. And Moses got downloaded when he was on top of Mount Sinai.
Exactly.
This is where it all began, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so did Moses initiate these other priests into some sort of secret unknown school of wisdom that really doesn't have anything to do with modern day or even ancient Judaism?
I think that's a very good question, and one that I addressed in the book. And what I discovered was following. Actually, I was tipped off by Robert Eisenman, who's a really well-known New Testament scholar. He talked about a lineage of beings called the Rainmakers. And among among the individuals in this group of priests, the Rainmakers, was a figure named Phinehas. Most people, if you follow the story of the Spear of Destiny, the spear that pierced the side of Christ on the cross, you know it's also called the Spear of Phinehas. He was also the guardian of the Ark of the Covenant after Moses' death. And so what it's telling us is that Moses actually may himself have initiated this line of priests called the Rainmakers, who guarded, actually disassembled the Ark of the Covenant and its pieces, and reassemble it throughout history, because the premise is that the Rainmakers are a continuous lineage. Elijah later appears as a Rainmaker. In the time of Jesus, it was Jesus' brother James who was the Rainmaker, the righteous Rainmaker, who sought and, I believe, acquired the Ark of the Covenant and the other tools in this messianic kit. So yes, there is this tradition of belief that there is a parallel mystery tradition along with the Ark that transmits its secrets. Now, your next question is probably, well, why are they called the Rainmakers? The reason is because when the Messiah comes and manifests, he comes through the clouds of heaven, and clouds bring rain. And the rain is a higher dimensional energy, a frequency, a vibration that manifests along with this figure. And so this is why in the Ark of the Covenant symbolism, we have the rainbow as a symbol of these of the Ark, as well as the Rainmakers, and also the imagery of the sun, and especially the concept of opening a portal or a gate. Because remember, when Jesus comes and goes, he does so through gateways or doorways.
Yeah, and it's often depicted this way with this symbology in medieval art. These rainbows and this sort of circular theme. Well, you mentioned the brother of Jesus. You think that he was initiated in this Rainmakers wisdom school or a priesthood. Did he, in fact, then assemble it so that Jesus could carry out some sort of, symbolic act upon his resurrection?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Because Jews don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. And the reason why is because he didn't fulfill the prophecies of the Messiah, and which include rebuilding the Temple of Solomon and bringing peace to the world and bringing gnosis, enlightenment, to the world. I mean, that's their opinion. But in Jewish legend, and this is part of the Rainmaker tradition as well, the Messiah has a to-do list. The Messiah will get the Ark of the Covenant, the flask of manna, the cruse of anointing oil, the rod of Aaron, and will assemble this kit. So by definition, the Messiah has to get the Ark of the Covenant. So if Jesus is the Messiah to the Christians, which as they believe he is, he's the Christos, the anointed one, then he had to have acquired this toolkit. And I make a case in the book that, in fact, all of the tools and implements that accompany the Ark of the Covenant, including the flask of manna and the anointing oil and the rod of Aaron, are present in the story of Jesus in the Bible and also in the apocryphal or extra-biblical tradition. So, yes, my answer is yes, James the Just, James the Righteous One, James the Rainmaker, Jesus' brother, did seek these tools or implements on behalf of his brother, did assemble them, and they were utilized at what we think of as the crucifixion. And then I take it even one step forward to say they disassembled these devices, these tools and implements, and hid them, knowing that there would be a second coming of Christ. And what we find in especially Last Judgment art showing the second coming is that all of the tools or implements I just described are featured as what is called the prepared throne of the second coming of Christ. It's all there. And it suggests to me that the Rainmakers are, if this is the end times, the Rainmaker is among us.
If what you're saying is true, then that would have to mean that the priesthood of the Rainmakers is still intact.
I agree.
They're absolutely walking the earth. So I have to ask, where and who do you think they are?
Well, they're defined. They're called the Ebionites. What's fascinating about this is the Ebionites were the followers of James the Just. You can trace them into the Eastern church tradition through Byzantium on into Macedonia, from Macedonia into southern France with the Cathars. And from there, you also can trace them into Islamic tradition, because in Islamic tradition, the 12th Imam, and this is, again, I'm citing Robert Eisenman, the New Testament scholar, in Islamic tradition, the 12th Imam, the hidden Imam, the guided one who will recover the Ark, his idea, the idea of this hidden Imam, is rooted in the concepts of the Ebionite tradition, the hidden or secret Adam ideology of the Christ. And so my answer would be, you might well make a case that the Shia faction of Islam, which is the ones who are ruling Iran today, are aware of at least what we have been talking about in the past hour, Rob. I mean, I'm just a guy that's done 25 years of research on this subject with limited resources, just one guy. If I'm Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and I believe, as he does, that I am divinely ordained to herald the appearance of the 12th Imam in the Ark of the Covenant, you've got to believe he's devoting tremendous resources to, A, fully understand what the Ark of the Covenant really is, and we're way out of the box here. We've left the Ark as a simple golden box way behind. I mean, if you do the research we've been doing, you readily understand that it's way beyond that. And Mahmoud Ahmadinejad must understand at least what we have been talking about this evening.
Hmm.
So I'm not saying he's the rainmaker,
yeah,
but I'm saying those are a couple of places you want to look.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go back to the mountaintop, Sinai, Mount Sinai, where supposedly Moses received the Ten Commandments, received all this information. It is said in the Kabbalic tradition that that's where he received the Kabbalah. And in fact, that's where every living soul that ever was or ever would be also received the Kabbalah. How is the Kabbalah associated with any of this, of your interpretation of the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, actually, I just decided to kind of leave the Kabbalah on the side with all due respect, because I realized quite early in writing this book that I was dealing with a really many-tentacled story here, lots of moving parts, and I just decided to keep it, to kind of condense it and focus it strictly on the idea that the Ark of the Covenant is the throne of the second coming of Christ.
Okay, fair enough.
And so I decided for now, And well understanding that the Kabbalah has to play an important role in this, I just decided to kind of leave it on the side for now.
Sure. Okay, well, in that same moment, you mentioned the architect of the Ark of the Covenant. Who was that?
Bezalel.
What do we know about him? Where does he come from? How did he gain this knowledge?
And here's the thing, and this is a really great question, Rob, because it opens up a lot of our thinking about the Ark. Bezalel was a highly gifted artisan, a craftsman, and I like to use the word craft because that's what alchemists do. They're masters of the craft. And before he made the Ark of the Covenant, Bezalel was given divine wisdom by God. The scholars who looked at this believe that that wisdom is the same wisdom that God used to create the world, which brought a question in my mind: why would God need to download Bezalel with the divine wisdom of the universe in order to make a simple golden box?
That's extraordinary.
He wouldn't. So that to me is a tip that we're talking about something far more profound than what you see in Raiders of the Lost Ark or other representations of it such as that. And I feel that what we're dealing with is a quantum type device. We are talking about a device that is made as much as it is manufactured. And when I say that, when I use the term made, I'm using it in the same way that police use the term made. When the police make a car, they don't manufacture it. They're identifying it. That's a 2012 Volkswagen or whatever. They make it, right? And the picture that began to emerge in my mind, Rob, is that Bezalel might have made the Ark of the Covenant in his mind. He could have been like a Nikola Tesla type who is said to have had the ability to make 3D models of his inventions in his mind and make them work. And as I followed that kind of intuition, I found out that there's this whole tradition that we can assemble or make the Ark of the Covenant and all its various implements within our own consciousness. That in fact, the Ark exists within us. That it is such a profound device that it is actually a consciousness device as much as it is an exterior material device. And that's when it really starts to get exciting, because we realize that that's what a lot of this artwork is about throughout the ages. Depicting the Ark of the Covenant is visual cues for the priests and other initiated ones who know that, hey, if you can visualize this device, meditate on it, you can actualize it within your own consciousness, and you become this incredible Stargate throne that we're describing here. You become the footstool for God. That's what it's all about. It's not about one single high priest on one day of the year entering a golden cube-shaped room. No, it's about us becoming the most holy place and bringing this divine presence into our being through awakening our heart and becoming beings of light and love and changing our world.
Mm. Well, the way you describe the creator of the Ark of the Covenant, it certainly sounds like it is the key to the universe.
That's exactly what it is. And that's why I call it the Judgment Day device, because as we manifest this will be the last human invention, because it will be a device that will bring peace to the world. We're talking about a free energy device here. We're talking about a device that connects us with the universe, that bumps us up one level on the evolutionary ladder. And as we begin to be able to visualize such a device, if we build it, it will come.
Hmm. Right. As the saying goes.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you about some of the tools, some of the components that you've been referring to. It is said that not only did the Ark of the Covenant contain the Ten Commandments, it also contained some of the manna that fell from the heavens that sustained the Jews as they were crossing the desert, and the rod of Aaron. Tell us about this.
Okay. We're talking about a toolkit here. We're talking about a container, a golden box that contains a magic wand, which is what the rod of Aaron was. It budded, it produced enlightenment. We're talking about the flask of manna, which is referred to as the star food, the celestial food. Jesus referred to it as the bread from heaven. And if you eat this, it awakened our consciousness. It sustained the Israelites for over 40 years while they're wandering in the wilderness. It's one of the most mysterious ideas that I've ever come across in myth and symbolism, this idea of a celestial food, a heavenly food that awakens our consciousness, promotes longevity, and connects us with the divine presence. And then, and one of the least known aspects of the Ark is the cruse of anointing oil that is placed within it. This oil is astounding. It's known to the Gnostics as chrism. They, in fact, in the Gospel of Philip, one of the Nag Hammadi Gospels, they identify, and the Gospel of Philip, by the way, is kind of an encyclopedia of Gnostic beliefs. They explicitly state in there that chrism, the sacred oil, is the source of the resurrection.
Hold it right there, because that's a great place to leave everyone hanging. When we come back, at the top of the hour, we will continue this discussion with William Henry. His book is called The Judgment Day Device, and his website is linked up right now at Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, we're going to continue this. We're going to go even deeper. We're going to talk about this device, where it is now, and what does it mean for the end time prophecies. My name is Rob Simone. You are listening to Coast to Coast AM.